As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Our show features our team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. And they'll help you make the most of your money while cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. You'll get clarity on strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
What follows may not be suitable for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised.
The world is full of stories. Stories of mysteries. Of curiosities. Of oddities. Join Kat and Jethro Gilligan Toth for the strange, the bizarre, the unexpected, as they lift the lid and cautiously peer inside the box of oddities.
I was just scrolling through the news feed in the Freaks group, a box of oddities podcast group, which, by the way, we just
the group page
we just cleared over. Like 11,000 some odd people.
Oh, really?
Our members, like 11,300 something.
So. I didn't realize it was that much.
Yeah, that's pretty great. I came across an article from Boing Boing that was posted by Joe.
Joe Vincent. Yeah. I love Joe Vincent.
Yeah, he's hilarious. Anyway, he posted this article. It's titled, Band Apologizes for Singer After She Pees on a Fan's Face During Concert. And interestingly enough, this just happened Thursday at Daytona International Speedway.
Oh, Florida.
Here in Florida.
Yay.
According to the Boing Boing article, a fan climbed onto the stage during Brass Against's rocking cover version of Rage Against the Machine's Wake Up. After singer Sofia Urista instructed the person to lie down on the stage, she then pulled her pants down and urinated right in the man's face. It seemed, according to the article again, it seemed he was wearing a camera strapped to his head, but she kindly encouraged him to remove it before the flow commenced. Judging from the video's evidence, the fan seemed quite pleased.
Oh, well, as long as everyone's having a good time.
Brass Against issued this apology on Twitter. Quote, we had a great time last night. Sophia got a little carried away. That's not something the rest of us expected. And it's not something you'll see again in our shows. Thanks for bringing it last night, Daytona.
Wow.
And people wonder why we moved to Florida.
This is why.
So Joe posts this, and then, of course, everybody's chiming in. Ashley wrote, her name is Urista.
She's like a barista, but for urine. She's a Urista.
Roxanne wrote, I heard this was a streaming event. And then Joe comes back with the winner. You could say she's raging against the latrine. Joe. Anyway, a Box of Oddities podcast group. If you're not on it, you're missing out.
Yeah, and I feel like we might be missing out too. Please bring your joy to us.
Yes.
Deliver your joy.
Just don't deliver it in a thick stream.
Stop. Blah, 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 blah.
All right.
A thick stream.
It was. Disgusting. I looked at the video.
No.
I did. It was a thick stream of urine and quite a high pressure one. I think that she just really had to go and decided to work it into the show.
All right. Well, you use what you have available to you. Did real quick want to mention that for the first time I am attempting to record while sitting on the beanbag chair, and Howard has made his way into my lap. So sorry for the inevitable interruptions.
Make yourself comfortable. I got a story.
Got it.
Almost exactly 300 years ago, November 28th, 1724, Peter the Great publicly beheaded Willem Mons. It happened in St. Petersburg, Russia. Mons had been arrested just 8 days earlier. He was the private secretary to Catherine, Peter's wife, and had been charged with breach of trust and embezzlement. But there seems to be potentially more to the story. Rumors at the time were swirling about that those charges were just kind of made up. They were trumped up charges. And his true crime, which he was executed for, was getting it on with Catherine.
Oh my goodness.
It's interesting to note how Mons came to the court in the first place. It seemed he knew people. He had connections. He was the brother to Peter the Great's longtime mistress, Anna Mons. So he's the brother of Peter the Great's mistress. He allegedly became a boy toy for Catherine, but that cost him his head.
Allegedly.
Now, Willem Mons.
I love the name Willem, by the way.
I do, too. He was officially Catherine's secretary when this affair allegedly began. He was incredibly handsome. In fact, one person in the court reportedly described him as, quote, the best made and most handsome man I have ever seen.
Wow. Yeah, I never trust accounts of anyone being handsome or good looking from 300 years ago.
Their definition of beauty was different.
Look at that giant silky white forehead.
And all those rotted teeth because they can afford sugar. But he was, what we do know, young, of German descent, reportedly very ambitious, and some would say opportunistic.
Okay.
He seemed to connect himself to the right people at the right time, people that had his best interests in mind or could further his career. This is how he climbed the social ladder until he reached the pinnacle of his career in 1724 when he became secretary and confidant to Catherine. Historian Robert K. Massey, in his biography of Peter the Great, wrote, quote, lurid stories circulated, including one that Peter had found his wife with Mons on a moonlit night in a compromising position in the garden. They were doing it in a hedge or something. So romantic.
Or something.
Now, there are those who doubt that the affair ever took place. Sure. And Massey writes that Catherine was very fond of Peter and knew well of his furious temper. For her to have an affair would be out of character for Catherine, according to Massey. Also, the story says that he was caught in the garden on a moonlit night, and he was executed on November 28th, 8 days after his arrest. That meant that they were outside in November 20th, getting it on in St. Petersburg. Now, I don't know what the temperature was on November 20th, 1724.
I bet there's a savant out there who could.
I would love to hear about it. What I do know is that the temperature in St. Petersburg, Russia, as I was researching this, was 32 degrees Fahrenheit.
Oof.
Or 0 degrees Celsius. So
that is not conducive to bonering.
No, it is not. It's an anti-bonering environment. No, I'm not saying it was impossible.
Of course not.
Because, you know, Catherine was a hottie.
Right, and she had that vacuum vag. Did you see that post
no,
on the Freaks group?
No, but I just enjoyed vacuum vag.
Okay.
Explain that to me.
So it was a post that someone shared of a meme stating how sex in the way that we do it is unnatural because the way that we're supposed to have sex is after we are married and very much in love. While sleeping, the woman's vacuum vag will invite the flaccid penis inside, and that's the only way that copulation is supposed to take place. The way that we do, like, quote-unquote forceful copulation is unnatural, according to this meme.
Wow. Another reason to join Freaks A Box of Oddities Facebook group. It's full of all kinds of wrong information. So because of all those conditions, it seems unlikely that they were caught doing it outside in the garden at night. I'm not saying the affair never took place. I'm just saying it probably happened inside. Anyhoozle, it was also likely that he was on the take soliciting bribes from pretty much anybody to get a message to the Empress and hopefully to Peter himself. Regardless, when Peter found out, he wasted no time. He immediately seized Mons's papers. Catherine was trying desperately to get a pardon from her husband, but to no avail.
And I'm sure that her trying to get a pardon only fueled the rumors that there was a love affair.
Probably. Within a week of his arrest, he had been sentenced to death by beheading and was quickly and publicly decapitated. Oof. Huge crowds gathered to watch in central St. Petersburg. Now, when this was happening, what was Catherine doing? The moment that Willem's head left his body, Catherine was with her daughters, rehearsing a minuet with their dance instructor. She was said to show no trace of emotion, and believe me, everybody was watching to see how she was going to react,
right.
You know, to see if more evidence.
Yeah, the paparazzi.
The 18th century paparazzi.
I don't know how you can so quickly reel off what century it is. Like, I really have to think about it. Yeah. I'm like, what year did you... Okay, so...
1720...
So the forward or the past one?
Yeah, I so just add 100. So if 1724, that would be the 18th century.
I can never remember, okay. Though, if it's adding or subtracting.
It's confusing, I know.
I can't tell if you're being serious.
Word is that Willem Maughan's execution had a serious negative impact on Peter and Catherine's relationship.
I would imagine, even if he weren't her lover.
They were co-workers, so to speak. Well, she was his employer. Massey writes in his biography of Peter...
Sounds like he was Peter the mediocre. Peter the bare minimum.
But that just doesn't have the same pizzazz as Peter the Great.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Peter the bare minimum.
You were saying.
Even after just a month... since he had been put to death, whispers at the court said that the two of them hardly ate together, Catherine and Peter, and they did not sleep in the same room anymore. So it could have just been the fact that her lover had been executed by Peter the Great that caused this division between Catherine and Peter. I'm sure that had a lot to do with it. But in my opinion, probably the thing that really drove the final wedge between Catherine and Peter was after Mons had been decapitated, Peter pickled his head in vodka and kept it in a large jar.
He displayed it.
He actually presented it to Catherine and required her to keep it on her nightstand in her bedroom at all times.
Okay, so that would definitely lead one to believe he had suspicions of an affair.
That would certainly lead me to believe that. Now, this, interestingly, wasn't the first time Peter had cut off a guy's head and pickled it. Well, at least a person. Peter's own lover, a few years earlier, Mary Hamilton, had been executed for crimes that included infanticide, abortion, and theft. He had her head preserved just the same way.
Was it on the other side of the bed? Because its symmetry is very important to me in design.
It's like some sort of morbid form of feng shui. And then about 3 months after the execution of Willem Maughan, Peter himself followed Maughan to the grave. He was 53 years old. He'd been battling bladder illness as well as cirrhosis. He was known to be a very, very heavy drinker. He invented what he called the vodka penalty shot. If anybody arrived late to any of his dinners or feasts or gatherings, mm-hmm. he forced them to do a penalty shot of vodka, which actually sounds kind of cool. That almost, in my mind, redeems him. So immediately I started thinking, well, shit, what happened to the heads?
Right, yeah.
Where are those pickled heads?
Where are those pickled heads?
Many years earlier, Peter had stumbled across a collection of oddities and curiosities.
Oh, wow.
They included such things as pickled human embryos and deformed animals. So Peter, being an inquisitive guy, decided he wanted his own. So he opened what was called the Kunstkamera in 1727. The Kunstkamera was actually the very first museum in Russia. Basically, he started collecting body parts and stuff and putting them in jars.
And does this museum still exist?
It does. It began with his own personal collection, and he stored them initially at his summer palace. It featured a large assortment of human and animal fetuses, anatomical deficiencies. The underlying idea was for the museum to acquire full knowledge of the world.
Through human bits.
Peter offered large sums of money for people to bring their pickled specimens, or better yet, live ones, to him. He encouraged research of deformities, along with trying to debunk superstitions such as monsters and things like that.
Oh, that's cool.
Ultimately, he issued a proclamation, an order, that all malformed stillborn infants be sent to him from all over the country.
Oh, Lord.
To his imperial collection. He then put them on display as examples of accidents of nature. So it seems logical that the pickled heads would end up in Peter's bizarre museum. And they did. Well, at least for a little while. They remained in the museum for about a half a century. It even survived a devastating fire that took place in 1747. In the 1780s, Catherine the Great, the wife of Peter the Great's grandson, was wandering through one day with her friend, Princess Dashkoff. They spotted the head of Mary Hamilton, and next to that was the head of William Mons on a dusty shelf, just kind of tucked back there with some old books.
Sure, sure.
According to scholar Oleg Neverov in 1985, quote, Princess Dashkoff and Catherine remarked on the wonderful preservation of these two beautiful young faces, still striking after the passage of 50 years. It's been said that some sense of propriety took hold, and she had them buried. So you're not going to find the severed heads of Peter the Great's wife's lover, or his lover, in this or any museum. Not anymore. However, the Kunstkamera does have a huge collection of specimens, everything from body parts to organs to human fetuses to deformed animals to Siamese twins to encephalitis swollen skulls to giant skeletons to jars of tumors. It's kind of like the Mutter Museum, just in Russia. It's now currently housed inside the Museum of Anthropology and Ethnography in St. Petersburg, Russia, which is still inside the Kunstkamera. So the Kunstkamera is like the building now. And inside is the Museum of Anthropology and Ethnography in St. Petersburg.
That sounds really interesting.
Yeah, there's some amazing pictures of stuff they've got there. It's very similar to the Mutter. My sources were Wikipedia, Atlas Obscura, Ranker, Culture Map, and Robert K. Massey's biography of Peter the Great. Heads in Jars. Who doesn't like a story about heads in jars?
And now, that thing in the middle. Acts of wartime propaganda can take many forms, some more creative than others. During the Cold War, the CIA considered airdropping XL condoms labeled medium over the Soviet Union to demoralize the Soviet male population and make them feel anatomically inferior and afraid to fight the U.S. The first word in box is box. Whoa, cool! This is the Box of Oddities.
You hear Kat and I talk a lot about Aura frames, and there's a reason for that. We live in Ecuador, and our family is all over the place. In fact, Kat right now is up visiting her mom, and when I say up, I mean Maine. We got her an Aura frame so we could share photos and videos from any device, and they'll instantly appear on the frame, which makes it easy because she's getting up there in years. It's easy to set up. It takes about 2 minutes to set up a frame using the Aura app, and it's the perfect gift for Mother's Day. Aura frames are beautiful Wi-Fi connected digital picture frames that allow you to share and display unlimited photos. It's super easy to upload and share photos via the Aura app, and if you're giving an Aura as a gift, you can even personalize the frame with preloaded photos and memories. It is the perfect gift for Mother's Day. Right now, Aura has a great deal for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get 30% off free shipping and their best-selling frame. That's A-U-R-A, frames.com. Use code ODDITIES at checkout to save. That's A-U-R-A, frames.com, and use code ODDITIES at checkout to save. Terms and conditions apply.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The nerds will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey there, I'm Dylan Lewis, one of the hosts of Motley Fool Money. Each weekday on Motley Fool Money, we talk through the business news you need to know and the stories moving stocks on Wall Street. On weekends, we dive into the industries shaping tomorrow and host the experts, authors, and executives that understand them. Tune in for insights, a long-term perspective on investing, and of course, stock ideas, plenty of them. To quote a listener, it pays to listen. Check us out and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Support for the Box of Oddities is provided in part by listeners like you on Patreon. You can support us too. Go to patreon.com/boxofoddities. Thank you. The Box of Oddities with Kat and Jethro Gilligan Toth.
Jay writes, so I'm on episode 92 about the Black Cursed Sarcophagus. That's the one where they made like...
the juice?
Yeah, mummy juice. Some sort of energy drink.
Yeah, allegedly. The mummy juice.
Yeah, mummy juice, yeah. The guy stated that the sarcophagus wasn't cursed, but part of me is curious is if COVID-19 is the result of opening that cursed mummy juice-filled box. I'd like to know how many of the people who opened it caught it. Kind of dark, but had to message you. I don't know. Love you guys. P.S. Oh, and Kat said 2019 was going to be the best year ever and probably set the curse into motion.
My fault.
And then
guys?
He goes, LOL, I'm dumb. Thanks, Jay, I guess.
I have a hard time not thinking about things like that. Like, you know, how many people who were there for the opening of the coffin ended up becoming ill. Mm-hmm. I think about things like that all the time. Like, I'll be up in the middle of the night because, you know, we're not good at sleep. And I'll think, like, how many people in the building are peeing right now?
Well, it's not surprising because you're the one who invented the poop chart when you were younger.
I did, yes. You know? Yeah, thanks for bringing that up.
Sure, no problem. Also, you're a descendant of cannibals. We haven't mentioned that in a while, but somebody sent us an ad for a tofu-based human meat that's now available. So they said Kat can still live her veg lifestyle and also honor her ancestry.
Oh, my goodness. You guys.
That's weird, though, isn't it? Vegetarian human meat.
Yeah, so you can make your own foot tacos.
Wow, lots of former episodes being referenced here. Mm-hmm. So tell me a story, weave me a tale, sing me a song.
Today we're going to talk about Bernice Frankel. She was born to New York parents, New Yorker parents, parents from New York. Mm-hmm. The style, chewy on the inside, crispy on the outside. New York parents. And sometime between 1922 and 1926, Bernice was popped out. The exact date is unknown. During the Depression, when she was about 11 years old, her family moved to Maryland from New York. And apparently after that move, Bernice reportedly faced anti-Semitic rejection. She considered herself a bit of a misfit and grew up painfully shy. At age 16, Bernice developed a serious condition called
coagulopathy.
Thank you. Coagulopathy. She wasn't well. Basically, it meant that her blood would not clot, and she was sent to an all-girls boarding school in Pennsylvania for her final 2 years of high school. I don't know why that was a solution to her blood not clotting, unless the anti-Semitic bullying was that bad. I don't know. Huh. I don't know what the connection is.
Interesting.
Either way, after that, she went to Blackstone College for 2 years, which was a junior college in Virginia, and then entered the Franklin Institute of Science and Arts, where she earned a degree as a medical laboratory technician. Now, I want to remind you, I said she was born between 1922 and 1926. So this is the early 40s that she's going to college.
They frowned upon educating women in those days.
Kind of rad, I'm just saying. So then in February of 1943, a call went out to women across the U.S. Be a Marine. Free a man to fight. The U.S. Marine Corps had established a women's reservists, making as many jobs open to women as they could. So the men who were performing those jobs could go out to the field, the strip, the mall. What's it called? The field?
What?
The front. There we go.
The mall.
Basically, they were putting as many women into as many positions as possible. I guess at this time, there were suggestions by the public about what to call these new female Marines, because they couldn't just be Marines, right? So they were like, what about the Glamarines or the Femarines? But General Holcomb actually said, no, we're not doing this.
Really?
They are Marines, he told Life magazine in 1944. They don't have a nickname and they don't need one. They inherit the traditions of Marines. They are Marines. Which I think was very cool of
very
that guy.
Forward thinking for the 40s.
Right. So Bernice Frankel enlisted as one of the first members of the United States Marine Corps Women's Reserve in 1943. They accepted her transfer request to the Motor Transport School in North Carolina, and then she worked as a truck driver and dispatcher in Cherry Point. In 1944, during her time in the military, she wed fellow Marine Robert Allen Arthur.
I know what this story is. Go ahead.
And then
I pieced this together.
You did?
Yeah.
And then she was honorably discharged at the rank of Staff Sergeant in September of 1945. So she went to New York and entered the New York School's famous dramatic workshop to study with Irwin Piscator, along with classmates Harry Belafonte, Walter Matthau, and Tony Curtis.
Wow, it's quite an illustrious group.
Mm. At some point, she began using the name Beatrice. And although she and Robert had divorced, she kept the surname Arthur. So B. Arthur made a career off-Broadway. And if your question is, are you eventually going to talk about each and every one of the Golden Girls? The answer is yes.
Mm-hmm. I don't think that was ever a doubt. Certainly not in my mind.
Bea Arthur's rad. The end. Bea was on stage, she was singing in nightclubs, and she was reading bit parts on Sid Caesar's Show of Shows. And she'd remarried to a guy named Gene Sachs in 1950. And it seemed like they liked each other, so that was nice. Bea Arthur's career took off when she landed the role of Lucy Brown in the long-running off-Broadway hit The Three Penny Opera in 1954. She received excellent reviews and was soon in demand as a character actress. She appeared in a few movies and TV shows, and then Norman Lear, the creator of All in the Family and longtime admirer of Bea Arthur, persuaded her to do a guest spot on the show in 1971, appearing as Maud. Well, immediately, the character Maud won the attention of CBS executives, and they worked with Lear to create a spin-off series called Maud, which premiered in 1972 and quickly moved into the top 10 in the Nielsen ratings, winning Arthur an Emmy in 1977. So by now, she's been a working woman, she's been a Marine, she's been in theater, and now she's got her own TV show. But the really cool thing about Bea Arthur is that she took every opportunity she could to use her career to bring issues that she cared about to the forefront of the cultural conversation, including the Vietnam War, issues regarding the Nixon administration. I guess at some point, Maud had a bid for a congressional seat. They talked about divorce, menopause, drug use,
abortion.
Mental illness, and abortion was a big one.
That was a really big one.
That episode aired right before the Roe versus Wade decision.
Crazy.
So it was a big deal. And then in 1978, she appeared in the Star Wars holiday special. So let's just go ahead and golf clap for that. Probably not at the top of her I'm so glad I did this list. In 1985, at the age of 63, Bea Arthur was cast in Golden Girls. The series, obviously a huge hit, it remained a top 10 rating fixture for 7 seasons, and she got several Emmy nominations over the course of the series and a win in 88. Bea decided to leave the show after 7 years, and in 92, the show was moved from NBC to CBS and retooled as a show called The Golden Palace. That only lasted a year.
Yeah, that was a letdown. I think most Golden Girls fans would agree. Maybe during the retooling, they could have cast that singer, Sophia, and they could have called it The Golden Shower.
Sophia was a character on The Golden Girls.
It's writing itself.
You stop talking about the urination thing? B. Arthur received...
I make no promises.
...the third most nominations for the Primetime Emmy Awards for Outstanding Lead Actress in a Comedy Series, with 9.
Wow.
Only Julia Louis-Dreyfus and Mary Tyler Moore have more than her.
That's nuts.
She made several guest appearances on television shows and organized and toured in her one-woman show. She made a guest appearance on Futurama. Actually, that episode was nominated for an Emmy as well.
She has the magic touch.
She really does. She appeared in the first season episode of Malcolm in the Middle. She was nominated for an Emmy for Outstanding Guest Actress in a Comedy for her appearance on Curb Your Enthusiasm.
No shit.
Anything that she's in basically is rad because she's B. Arthur.
Except for the Star Wars Christmas special.
Except for that. Yeah. In 2005, Bee put on a performance of her one-woman show to raise money for the Allie Forney Center. That night, she helped raise $40,000 and gave the center some serious help at a tough time during the recession. The Allie Forney Center is the largest LGBT community center helping homeless youth in the United States and doing so much more. And it's one of the only reasons that they could stay open is because she did this incredible philanthropy event. In her personal life, she was pretty private and introverted, but she was always involved in social issues like this. She was a champion for equal rights, for women, for the LGBTQ community, for animals. Television writer Charlie Hoke repeated a story several times about an instance when she just showed up on set with a German Shepherd that she'd found running along the highway, and she wasn't just going to leave it. So obviously, now there's a German Shepherd on set. Get over it. And I love that. In 2004, she appeared in the California Senate alongside Senator John Burton in support of a bill to ban the production and sale of foie gras. She was also so focused on helping to raise money for HIV/AIDS research. She appeared in the 1992 Pacific Center HIV/AIDS benefit along with her friend Angela Lansbury, which, looking back at pictures of them together, like, they were a couple of cuties. And when I would have seen that picture as a child, I would have been like, wow, those ladies are old. But looking back, I'm like, look at you cuties.
Perspective. It changes everything.
It really does change everything. Now, sadly, Bee Arthur did die of lung cancer at her home in Los Angeles in 2009. But even after that, we're finding out about what an amazing person she was and how much she cared about those issues. Her will was largely donations to organizations that she cared about. And several organizations have said that they would not have been able to continue without her incredible support.
That is the mark of a truly kind person, when you find out after they're gone the extent of their philanthropic involvement.
Right.
They're not doing it for the publicity.
Right.
They're doing it because it's the right thing to do.
And the Bee Arthur Residence, which opened in 2017, is an 18-bed residence in Manhattan for homeless LGBT community, for homeless LGBT youth operated by the Allie Forney Center. And again, possible only because of her incredible generosity.
Bee Arthur, everyone.
Right?
Wow.
She was a Marine.
At a time when women weren't Marines, this was a new thing. What an inspiration. She really made a difference in her life, didn't she?
Yeah.
So the holidays are upon us. If you're looking for gift ideas, might we suggest Box of Oddities merch?
Wow.
I don't know.
I didn't know that that's where this conversation was going, but yes.
Yeah.
Nothing says, let's rejoice in the spirit of the season, like a Eat a Bag of Dicks t-shirt.
Which is available now at theboxofoddities.com. You can find the link on our page. We appreciate you guys so much, and we look forward to seeing you next time.
Until then, keep flying that freak flag.
And fly it proudly, you beautiful freak.
And so, let it be known that the Box of Oddities belongs to you, and its fate is in your hands. Therefore, it's been requested by those to whom I report to beseech you for assistance. We ask but one thing of you, to provide a 5-star rating and a positive review. True, that is two things. However, 'tis merely a 5-star rating and a positive review. Also, subscribe to us. Okay, so three things is all we ask. Three things and three things only. Henceforth, the Box of Oddities commits to the telling of stories. Stories of the strange, the bizarre, the unexpected. We wish to offer our deeply felt gratitude and appreciation for your patronage. TheBoxOfOddities.com. Copyright 2021. All rights reserved.
Have you ever wondered how inbred the Habsburgs really were? What women in the past used for birth control? Or what Queen Victoria's 9 children got up to? On the History Tea Time podcast, I profile remarkable queens and LGBTQ+ royals, explore royal family trees, and delve into women's medical history and other fascinating topics. Join me every Tuesday for History Tea Time, wherever fine podcasts are enjoyed.
If you like this podcast, can we recommend another one? It's called Big Picture Science. You can hear it wherever you get your podcasts, and its name tells part of the story. The big picture questions and the most interesting research in science.
Seth and I are the hosts. Seth is a scientist. I am Molly, and I'm a science journalist. And we talk to people smarter than us, and we have fun along the way. The show is called Big Picture Science, and as Seth said, you can hear it wherever you get your podcasts.